Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
So now it's my pleasure to introduce Anna LaPay, author of Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. For more than a decade, Anna has been a force in driving home the point that climate change and food production need to be discussed together, and is a leading voice in the growing international movement for sustainable food. Together with her mother, Frances Moore LaPay, Anna is founder of Small Planet Fund, founding principal of the Small Planet Institute, and one of the innovators of the Glenwood Institute for Sustainable Food and Farming. She has authored several books, including Hope's Edge, winner of the Nautilus Award for Social Change, and currently appears as the host of MSN's The Practical Guide to Healthier Living and the 13-part public television series The Endless Feast. Anna is an active board member at the Center for Media and Democracy and the Rainforest Action Network, and a former board member of the Community Food Security Coalition. She has been featured as one of New York Times Magazine's food fighters and was named one of Time's Eco Who's Who. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Anna LaPay.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks everyone for being here. I'm going to put my water down here and move this a little bit, maybe? Or is that okay? Is that fine? It feels kind of high. Can we move it? Sorry. I just feel like I would have had a mic in my eyesight there. Thank you for accommodating me. Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you for the invitation to join all of you here in such a beautiful place. I got in a few hours ago and was able to just spend some time kind of soaking it all up. And as somebody who was born and raised in California, grew up in San Francisco and Oakland, but who's been spending 15 years in Brooklyn, New York, I gotta say, it was really nice to get off the plane and arrive back here. It feels very much like home. And I also want to say, related to some of what I want to share with you tonight, that, you know, I had this moment getting off the plane. I don't know how many of you have been to SFO's new Terminal 2, but getting off the plane just a few hours ago and walking by what I never thought I would ever see in my entire life, never have even dreamed it, a sign that said, Farm to Flight, and had local sustainable foods from this region at an airport. So I thought, you know, I'd sort of share a little bit of that with you. And I did also enjoy some of that farm-to-flight food. So tonight I want to talk a little bit about this food and climate connection that was alluded to in the intro, but really more broadly kind of share with you some of what I've been thinking about recently about how is it that we are hearing the story of food told to us? What is it that we think we know and why, and how that story has been changing and how I'm sensing it changing. And to begin, I wanted to share with you something I heard this past week that, again, I sort of, it's kind of the flip side of the story of SFO's Terminal 2, of sort of, I never thought I would hear something so grave and terrible. But I was talking with a pediatrician who works in a practice outside of Portland, Maine, and he was telling me that he now has patients who are coming in their early 20s in need of dentures, because they have been raised on our high sugar diet and drinking sodas all of their lives. And that he has colleagues working in practices in parts of the Midwest where children are coming into the practice whose legs are breaking under the weight of their completely diet-related illness, obese bodies, that their legs can no longer hold their weight, their legs are breaking, and this doctor was talking about having to develop in his practice a way to reset the bones of these young people who were coming in with broken limbs. So, you know, I think we've long been hearing about the pretty grave impact of diet-related illnesses in this country and going global, related to this kind of high-fat, high-salt, high-sugar, highly processed diet. These two examples I just gave you, to me, are kind of my most recent is it really this bad kind of moments? But we've sort of long been hearing about that. But I think we've also started over the past few decades coming to also understand all the other impacts, not just these health impacts, but a whole range of environmental impacts. And my most recent work over the past couple of years has been really trying to understand this climate impact, that when you really look at the entire food system from seed to the farm, to plate, to landfill, that at a conservative estimate is about one-third of all global greenhouse gas emissions are connected to our food system. And food and agriculture is especially so worrisome because 90% of nitrous oxide, of course, one of the key, very potent greenhouse gases, and two-thirds of anthropogenic methane emissions come from agriculture. And remember, methane is 23 times and nitrous oxide 296 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So the fact that the food sector has this direct relationship to those two greenhouse gases in particular makes it even more of concern. But as I started doing this research, what I also started realizing is that there's a good news part of this story. And the good news, and I'll circle back to this in a moment, is that we're learning more and more every day, but we're learning more and more how our food system can actually be a part of providing nourishing food, food that doesn't make us sick, safe food, can be part of ecological healing and actually part of helping us stabilize the climate. All doing this while also helping feed the planet and growing crops that are very resilient to kind of climate instability. So I was learning all of this, both kind of this dark side of industrial food, but also the potential, what I kept being struck by is this sense of still feeling like so many people have some pretty big questions and don't understand these issues and sort of don't believe in the potential of sustainable agriculture to be this kind of great environmental hero in a way and help us deal with all these interlocking crises. In fact, when I give talks like this across the country, I hear pretty frequently the same questions. I don't know if these are questions kind of knocking around in your minds, but I hear questions like, but isn't industrial agriculture just simply much more efficient than sustainable farming? Or can't we genetically engineer crops to be drought resilient, and won't that be the way to deal with the climate crisis? Or probably most common of all, can we really feed the world with sustainable food and sustainable farming methods? And these are the same questions I hear again and again and again. And what I've come to realize is these are the questions that I'm also hearing again and again and again in the press releases I see from food industry players. They're sort of in their talking points. And so this evening, what I want to dig into a little bit together is this idea that part of the reason why there are still so many doubts in the public mind about the negative side, the negative story of industrial food, and the positive story of sustainable food and farming is because of a very powerful manufacturing message machine of the food industry, a sort of spin that has shaped our beliefs about the food system, our beliefs about what's possible, and also our beliefs in turn about health, the environment, and now also we know the climate as well. So what is kind of the core strategy that we're seeing deployed in this spin campaign? It's this core strategy, we've seen it across corporations, across sectors. The strategy is sowing the seeds of doubt. So let me flash back to a different era, a slightly different issue, 1969. Marketing executives from tobacco giant Brown and Williamson articulated back then a key strategy to counter what they called the growing anti-cigarette forces. In an internal company memo, marketing executives wrote, quote, "Doubt is our product. It is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. It is also the best means of establishing a controversy." Okay, doubt is our product. And there's a great book by that title, Doubt is Their Product, that I highly recommend for those of you who want to learn more about this story. So flash forward to the climate change debate heating up in the early 2000s. And you get to a story of Frank Luntz, a political consultant hired by Republicans, who really ripped a page from the tobacco industry playbook. And in a 2003 memo that was leaked to the press, Frank Luntz had written, quote, "Voters believe at the moment that there is no consensus about global warming within the scientific community. Should the public come to believe that the scientific issues are settled, their views about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to continue to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate. Doubt is our product. He didn't say that, but that's essentially what he's saying, right? But as was true about the body of facts surrounding tobacco, we had then, we have now, a body of fact about climate change, and we had then and we have now a body of fact about industrial agriculture and its impact on the planet. So we know, for instance, that as we've come to be concerned about climate change, that we know that there are these human decisions that are disrupting our ancient and balanced carbon, nitrogen, methane cycles. And we also know, as I said at the beginning, alluded to this a little bit, that industrial food is really a part of undermining these cycles. We can look at each of them, nitrogen, methane, and carbon dioxide, and I'll just mention really briefly. So the nitrogen cycle, what's that food connection? Essentially, since just the turn of this last century, we invented a way to mass produce synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, and as a result, have completely set off the balance of the nitrogen cycle. One soil expert I spoke to for the book said, we've essentially taken the pre-industrial nitrogen cycle and doubled it. The system is not set up to keep cycling that nitrogen through. It just goes back out again. It ends up as acid rain, nitrates in the water, or nitrous oxide emissions in the atmosphere. Take methane and the methane cycle. You know, we've always known that ruminants, those are animals like cattle, you know, that we've always known that part of the natural digestion cycle is to emit methane. That's part of what they do. But when you start to have an industrial agriculture system that confines those animals, that expands exponentially the population of those animals, that starts becoming a serious factor. But more importantly, what's happened with industrial feedlots, not just ruminants, but all livestock in industrial feedlots, is you remove animals from the land, and as a result, you concentrate them, and you concentrate another aspect of their lives, which is their waste. And what you do is take what was once a precious source of fertility, and you turn it into essentially a toxic mess that has all kinds of repercussions, including becoming a major source of methane and disrupting that methane cycle. We also know that on farms, healthy soils are a significant methane sink. They're a way for us to trap and store our methane. And that were we to undermine these soils through industrial farming or through destroying rainforests to grow more monoculture crops, that too would have a serious impact on the methane cycle. And finally, in terms of the carbon cycle, we're seeing how industrial agriculture has this incredible impact on undermining soil health, and by doing that, releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that we know agribusiness is one of the biggest forces behind rainforest destruction, which is, of course, completely undermining that carbon cycle. So this climate food connection, it's not just conjecture, it's real, it's happening, and this kind of food, the same food system that's having this climate impact is also having, I mentioned at the beginning, these incredible diet-related illness impacts. It's also having all kinds of impacts on other aspects of our environment. So as many of us are kind of waking up to these factors, and we can think about whether it's, I just recently saw that Food Inc. was just named as one of the top-selling DVDs of all time. So many of us have read The Omnivore's Dilemma, so much so that in one industry press article I read on these issues, they said they were lamenting that the American public has been pollinated, P-O-L-L-A-N-ated, that too many people have read his books, too many people are raising too many questions. Eric Schlosser's Faster Nation 10 years ago, and we can go back even further. We can go back 60 years ago to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and what she alerted us to in terms of what we knew then, what we know now about the impact of pesticides and agricultural pesticides. So many of us are waking up to these concerns, asking questions. And as a result, and I think as this comes as no surprise to me, the food industry has gotten very busy. This year alone, we have heard of at least $100 million pledged to two new marketing campaigns to sow the seeds of doubt in the public's mind about the very issues that Michael Pollan raises, Eric Schlosser raises, Rachel Carson raises, that I've raised tonight. One that was launched in March is called the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. It's made up of dozens of trade groups of the biggest players in the food industry, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the National Corn Growers Association, and so on and so on. And what are their sort of communication strategies? Well, one of the things they've done is hired the word-of-mouth marketing firm called the Zocalo Group. If any of you speak Spanish, you might know what the word Zocalo means. It means that public square where you come together as a community. So what does the Zocalo Group do? It's a sort of commercialized, privatized form of that. It's a word-of-mouth marketing firm. In other words, it's like when you're sort of spending time with your friend and she tells you about how great Chilean sea bass is, and you say, well, doesn't the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch Guide tell us, you know, we shouldn't really, we should be avoiding that? And they say, no, it's not overfished, and don't worry about that mercury. You just don't realize that that best friend of yours is being paid to tell you that. That's sort of part of what word of mouth is, right? So that's one of the groups they've hired. And what's the other group that they've hired? Frank Luntz. The same person I mentioned earlier, this climate change denial spin master, Frank Luntz and his firm has also been hired by this alliance. And as they said, choosing Frank Luntz and his team is, quote, the next strategic step driving our mission to strengthen the image of agriculture and enhance public trust in today's best production practices. Of course, they don't define in that quote, you know, what do they mean by best production practices, but they mean chemical intensive agriculture, they mean confined animal feedlots, they mean the kind of farming that their members do. So then in addition to that, the other big campaign launched this year is called the Alliance to Feed the Future, which you gotta say, great name. Who could be against feeding the future? And it was launched to combat what they said were misperceptions about modern food production and technology and help more consumers appreciate the role of modern agriculture in providing safe, affordable, nutritious food. It's 52 members. There are 52 members at last count. Its 52 members include many trade groups I didn't even know existed, like the Frozen Pizza Institute. I didn't realize there was one, but apparently when we're all going hungry, we're really going to want our pepperoni frozen pizza. There's also the Institute, there's a lot of institutes, the Institute of Shortening and Edible Oils, the Association for Dressing and Sauces. Maybe they could tell us finally what actually is in ranch-style dressing, because I still don't know. There's CropLife America that represents all the agricultural chemical manufacturers in the country. It actually used to be called the National Chemical Manufacturers Association until I think they got some marketing team in there and rebranded themselves CropLife. And there's the calorie. This is one of my favorites, because the irony here is seems very striking. There's the Calorie Control Council, which represents the sugar and fat substitutes industry. So these are the people who brought us aspartame, saccharin, fat substitutes like Alestra that you might remember, you know, had some unpleasant impacts on our bodies, right? So, you know, call me cynical maybe, but I just don't think that diet soda is going to be our pathway to feeding the future. So these are just two, and there are a few more. In fact, I just saw the American Meat Institute just released its MythBusters website, sort of busting myths that we are putting out there, the sort of the pollinated minds are putting out there about confined animal feeding operations. So the American Meat Institute has their new MythBusters campaign. But so despite what you're going to hear from these groups and others, that like tobacco and like the climate crisis, we actually have a growing global consensus about the safest, healthiest kinds of foods, that we have a growing global consensus about the farming methods that will best help us feed the planet's growing population, especially in an era of depleted natural resources and climate crisis. We have this consensus, but I think many of us have no idea that we do. We don't hear about it. We have, in the food world, our own IPCC. So that stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the scientific body of experts that kind of have created this global consensus about where climate science stands, right? They won the Nobel Prize with Al Gore. We have the equivalent of that, in a way, for food and agriculture. But I have yet to speak to an audience where many people, or more than a handful of people, have actually ever heard of what that group is. I don't know if any of you have heard of what this group is. Maybe you're a savvy exception. But it's called it's a bit of a mouthful. It's called the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development. It's a comprehensive evaluation of global agriculture that really tried to model itself in a way on what the IPCC did. What they did is, for 4.5 years, 400 scientists and development experts from 80 countries worked together on this report that was eventually endorsed by 58 countries, not ours, but 58 countries. And that 2008 report found that one of their findings was that industrial agriculture, and as they said, the political, economic, and institutional arrangements supporting it, may at times have increased crop yields in certain places in the world, but at enormous cost to the public health, the environment, social and gender equity, and to, as they put it, the very foundations of food security. To give just a taste of some of the data, in one study of farmers in India, for instance, farmers that sort of modernized with some of these industrial techniques, researchers found in this one study a 10 to 20% yield increase, yes, but that was connected to, depending on the farm that they were looking at, a 43 to 260% increase in energy consumed. This report found that the most efficient farming methods, especially for most of the world's farmers, who also, by the way, are among the world's poorest people, that the most efficient farming methods are those, and, you know, this is kind of one of those, well, yeah, duh, but, you know, it took 4.5 years in this scientific consensus to really say this with confidence. The most efficient farming methods are those that do not undermine natural resources or require costly inputs to put them in place. This kind of farming goes by many different names. I've talked about it this evening as sustainable farming, sustainable food. Other people talk about this as agroecological food and farming. I also like when many people are starting to call it knowledge-intensive farming versus chemical-intensive or input-intensive. This kind of farming, it's knowledge-intensive because it's complicated. A successful, sustainable farmer must understand crop characteristics and weather and microclimate, soil types and fertility, pests and disease threats and field rotation schemes and livestock and crop interactions and market demand and a host of other factors. This isn't simplistic going back to kind of how our great grandfathers farmed. This is taking the best of what we know about ecological systems and applying them to farms today. And so the report concluded in no uncertain terms, business as usual is no longer an option. This is a groundbreaking study. You know, this is an incredible consensus, again, that we have heard so little about here. And there's more. There's a study out of the University of Essex, which, in the largest study of its kind, looked at 286 agricultural projects in 57 countries, including 12.6 million farmers, and essentially came to the same conclusion, that as you transform these farms into more agroecological farms, that actually you found not a sacrifice of yield, but a yield increase, but also an incredible amount of co-benefits, like increased biodiversity and healthier soil that was more able to trap and hold more water, better soil that was healthier in times of drought. You know, these are the conclusions that they found. The President's Panel on Cancer last year, for instance, came to a similar conclusion coming at it from a health angle. They identified, they said, at least 1,400 chemicals in our food supply today as possible carcinogens, meaning they may be cancer-causing, and urged Americans to stay away from food raised with antibiotics, pesticides, and other pharmaceuticals. They did not use the word, but essentially, if you're staying away from food raised with antibiotics, pesticides, and other pharmaceuticals, it means you're choosing organic, sustainable food. A University of Michigan meta-analysis of a number of global studies and national studies looking at organic and sustainable farming versus industrial farming, again, came to similar conclusions. And then there's what I have heard with my own ears over these past 10 years. I've heard this consensus about what kind of farming is most needed from probably most powerfully, most emotionally, farmers in India's Punjab. This was the place that was supposed to be kind of industrial agriculture's proving ground, where they were kind of sold on a package of fertilizers and pesticides. And I sat with these farmers as they told me about their destitution as a result of this pesticide and financial treadmill, and told me that they knew many, many, many friends, many, many, many fellow villagers in the surrounding villages who had gone, because they were so destitute, had gone into their fields and drunk the very pesticide that was supposed to make them thrive on their land and committed suicide. Today, I just heard an Indian economist speaking who said that he estimates that every 30 seconds an Indian farmer commits suicide. But I've heard this consensus about what kind of farming farmers want around the world. I've heard it in Mali, in Kenya, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Poland, Ghana, Ethiopia, all around the world. I have yet to meet a farmer in any of those countries. I have yet to meet a farmer who says to me, yes, what I would really like are some very expensive seeds that I have to buy year after year because they lose their vigor year to year and that prevent me from sharing them or saving them. I have yet to meet a farmer that says, yes, I'd really love to get some really expensive chemicals that may pollute my groundwater, that may give my children cancer, that may indebt me to my moneylender. I have yet to meet a farmer that says, yes, I'd love to be hooked on farming practices that make me completely dependent on fossil fuels. And I have yet to meet someone that says, yes, I'd love it if you could bring your American diet to us so that our healthcare system that's already so crippled by dealing with malaria or dealing with all these other diseases will now face the diet-related health crisis. I have not heard this anywhere from any farmer I have met. Instead, what I have heard is this common vision, this common consensus. And it's, you know, I think about it, I feel like I can, you know, hear these words that have come to me, whether it's in Portuguese or Kiswahili or Spanish or Bengali or Hindi and Polish, of farmers around the world who have shared their stories of how they are developing highly sophisticated farming techniques to feed their communities and doing so in a way that does not harm themselves, does not harm the soil, and in fact is helping heal the planet. It's a beautiful vision, and I'm hearing it all around the world. So as much as I feel like so many of us are still asking those questions, are still asking, but wait, don't we need industrial agriculture to feed the world? And wait, you know, don't we need genetically modified crops to help us deal with the climate crisis? As much as I keep hearing those questions, I also feel like I am hearing this growing sense of a shift of consciousness, that the reality of the impact of our current industrial food system, it's no longer something that can be explained away, even though I think Frank Luntz is very smart and he might try, you know, even though these alliances might have $100 million budgets. And, you know, I think we can take a bit of hope and inspiration from looking at some of the other things I've mentioned tonight. So you think about it. For decades, after we knew cigarettes caused cancer, for decades, the industry doubt spin machine perpetuated those questions, right? Perpetuated that doubt. So as recently as the 1960s, my grandmother was actually essentially prescribed by her doctor to smoke cigarettes to help her relax. And as recently as 40 years ago, when my uncle was studying medicine, there were cigarette vending machines in his hospital. And last week, when I went to a New York City hospital, the entire block around that hospital was a no-smoking zone, right? We've seen that shift of consciousness. For more than a century after the scientific community started raising concerns about global warming, and for more than now, it's been several decades that we've had this irrefutable evidence about the climate crisis. While there might be still some in that climate change denial camp, most of the world knows that the time for doubt is over. And I believe when it comes to food that with the mounting evidence about the true cost of our industrial food system, this damage to our health, the inability of the system to address the root causes of hunger, the damage to our climate, to our climate, that we will soon see a day, and I don't think I have to dream too far into the future, that organic farming will be just common sense. You know, that my daughter who's two, you know, I think I can imagine in her generation that she'll say to me, you know, that is just so crazy that people used to spray chemicals that they knew messed with your hormones and mimicked testosterone and estrogen on your crops. You know, that's just crazy that you used to spray chemicals that caused Parkinson's and miscarriages on food that you would eat, right? And that good, healthy food, you know, that you would walk into the cafeterias of every school in this country and you would just expect to see a salad bar, that would just be what every school has, right? And, you know, you might think this is slightly idealistic, but as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, there is a farm to flight in Terminal 2 at SFO, and I did get an organic shiitake mushroom vegetable wrap with miso ginger dressing at an airport. And, you know, this may seem idealistic, but think about it. If somebody had told you just a few years ago that the White House would have an edible garden in its lawn, right? You probably would have thought that person was crazy. So I think that it is our time to realize that there is this global consensus, that consciousness is shifting, and that hopefully it won't be too long from now that organic and sustainable farming will be such common sense. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anna. I think one of the things that we all like about your book and also your presentation is it's a good mixture of common sense and facts. And I think it makes it very accessible. I want to take just a minute to remind our radio audience that we're talking with Anna LaPay, author of Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. Tonight's Natural and Creative Capital program is hosted by the Montavo Arts Center and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. You know, as we sit here in Silicon Valley, if you go an hour east, an hour north, or an hour south, you'll run into small farms, you'll run into orchards, you'll run into agribusiness. And this is also the state where in 2006 it was passed AB 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act. And I wonder if you had a chance at all to look at that act, especially as it relates to agriculture. I looked a little bit at it and saw that there was some bits on manure management, some diesel truck things. And I kind of posed that to you as a question about what role should government be playing in all this and setting standards?
Yeah, it's a great question. And of course, government plays a huge role. It's not a question of what role. It's not a question of whether they'll play a role. It's a question of what kind of role they will play. Will it be helping move us in the right direction or not? And I think this is where public consciousness plays such a role because, of course, despite some of our cynicism about feeling like we are heard by our elected officials, you know, we still exist and live in a democracy where the fact that we as a community of people who care about healthy food, get activated and educated, that we can let our elected officials know that we want to see policies that reflect that. And one of the opportunities around that, of course, is on the national level is the Farm Bill, which comes up for renewal next year. And this is where I feel that we need to better educate ourselves about these food and climate connections to understand what are the kinds of things we'd like to see in the Farm Bill that would help us really be supporting what we could call climate-friendly farming versus having a kind of agriculture that undermines those three cycles that I mentioned. And I'll give you just a real concrete example. There are a number of really fabulous initiatives in the Farm Bill that I and many of my colleagues would love to see expanded. So things like the Farmers Market Nutrition Program. It's a program that helps low-income people access healthy food at farmers markets. It's a nutrition program, but I would argue in a slightly indirect way, that's a climate-friendly farming program because what it's doing is it's providing money and resources into the pockets of our frontline farmers who are our small-scale, mid-scale farmers who are using those practices that are so good for the environment. So expanding that nutrition program helps eaters get access to that good food, but it also helps those farmers who are really protecting our natural resources, protecting our farmland and stewards of the land. It helps keep them on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Thank you. I also want to mention that we have several good questions from our audience tonight, and I want to jump right into those. One regards just kind of the what appears to be, at least here in the Bay Area, the food competition, food store competition. Walmart is into food. Target has food. There are many smaller grocery stores popping up, Sprouts, things like that. Can you talk about that as a phenomenon and what we as consumers should be looking for?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we were having true competition, I think that would be a positive, right? Economists tell us that once you have a market where just a handful, four companies control 40, 50% of that market, you no longer have that true competition. And so, I'm not familiar with what's happening here in this region, but I know nationally one of the problems with our industrial food system has been a lack of regulation around competitiveness in the marketplace. And so you have a situation where there isn't real competitiveness, and as a result, consumers pay because you're not getting a fair price. And I think Walmart is a great example of a company that has effectively switched the playing field and created an unfair playing field. In other words, there's great data that shows that when Walmart comes to town, all the other, a lot of other businesses go out of business. And by Walmart getting into the food business, they now, I just recently saw their, I think, take about one out of every $4 that we're spending on food in this country. That Walmart going into the food business in a lot of regions, that they're the only player in town. And I don't think that's good for competitiveness. I don't think that's good for the consumer. So I think that true competitiveness would be what we need. And I think that we need a more active government role in enforcing some of the antitrust laws to help us keep that competitiveness there.
Thank you very much. And that kind of raises a follow-up question just about what the organic and sustainable food industry needs to do to be able to really scale up to meet the need of those consumers. Because the Walmarts and the Targets are obviously providing that food as another way to keep people in their store longer. It gets them a few extra bucks. It's another reason they can do three things at once at Target. But what is the movement really need, though, to scale up to the point where that kind of food would be available at Target?
Right, that's right. Yeah, and I think this is, I mentioned in the talk, what are the common questions that I hear? And this question about, could we really scale this up? Can this really, really be not just fringe, not just a few percent of our food supply, but really scale it up? And I think the answer is absolutely yes, but it can only be scaled up if it's done in a way, in essentially the same way that the industrial sector has been scaled up, which is heavy government investment. You think about all the infrastructure that's gone in to really support a certain kind of food system, right? So the infrastructure that's built around whether it's very, very large slaughterhouses long-distance travel or distribution hubs that are really, really large scale that have shut down a lot of the smaller regional hubs. And so part of, I think, the only way we're going to scale up is to do this really important thing that I think for a lot of people doesn't sound that exciting or that sexy, but build infrastructure. we really, really need to realize that we can't blame the small-scale, mid-scale farmers for not being able to, say, effectively distribute when they don't have that infrastructure in place. And in my state where I live now, in New York, we often hear about, we produce all kinds of products, especially apples and lettuce and all these products, and we have one of the biggest school districts in the country, and yet we're shipping in apples from the West Coast. We're shipping in lettuce from California. No offense to your lettuce, but we've got some lettuce in our state. Why are we doing that? Because we don't have that infrastructure set up. And so part of the public consciousness shift, I think, is in the same way that I feel like we've been doing a pretty good job at shifting a lot of our consciousness about the need to invest in energy infrastructure, so alternative energy infrastructure, whether that's wind or solar. I think we're starting to get it that we need to invest in transportation infrastructure, right? We need that same consciousness shift about food, that in order to have sustainable ecological food, we also need to talk about infrastructure. And I was excited to see the USDA just release this fabulous new study on food hubs and regional food infrastructure, and mm-hmm. a lot of people at the USDA get this.
Well, one of the things, especially we know here in Silicon Valley, where there's a lot of energy put in green innovation, and whether it's solar and biodiesel and different aspects, energy conservation, metering, that kind of thing, is there's money to be made in some of those solutions. And I wonder if there's a a comparison within the food industry that would ignite some of that innovation. And if so, what it might be. Because as you mentioned, obviously the government gives, there have been regular subsidies for solar installations, for energy efficiency. But again, it's because there's a product there that somebody was trying to push forward and to innovate on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, of course, where we want to be careful with investment in food and farming and agriculture is to not create speculative markets, to not create to not invest in it expecting you're going to get 20, 30, 40% returns. That there's one of the kind of writers and thinkers about this kind of investment is Woody Tash, who wrote Slow Money, and sort of trying to think about what does investment look like when you care about soil fertility, when you care about ecological systems, and, you know, can you expect a slower return and maybe not quite such a high return. But I also think that that this point around innovation and research is so critical to raise because, and again, to kind of go back to this theme, you can look at, we already spend a lot of our tax dollars on agricultural research, but 98% of that isn't going to these ecological kinds of farming practices that I've discussed tonight. Why isn't it? Why couldn't it be? And that's, again, a decision that gets set in the Farm Bill and is something that we can all say, look, let's be innovative, and let's be innovative in a really smart way, in this way that won't potentially damage ecological systems.
Great. I think that's very important. Let's switch to for a minute to something, a real practical question, because we have several of these that say, basically, how the heck do I know if something's organic when it says organic? And is the word organic watered down in the items that I buy? Mm-hmm. Is there any advice that you can just share mm-hmm. about how you can tell the quality of the food mm-hmm. that you're getting?
Well, first, and you know, I'll say this because we're also in a region where you could really act on this. I think first, if you can get yourself to a farmer's market or get yourself to a store where you know that the produce buyers are buying regional, buying local, and you trust where they're buying their food, you know, that's sort of number one. I always think about, I like to be able to go into a store and not have to think very hard and just to kind of grab whatever I want. And there's a food co-op that I belong to in Brooklyn. It kind of functions that way. There's sort of already been a set of decisions made about what goes in the door. But I feel the same way at a farmer's market, that I can trust what's there. Of course, you want to ask questions even at a farmer's market. But, you know, those are places to really get you that access. The second thing, very, very practical, that I don't think many people know, that I love to mention, super simple. When you are in a supermarket in the produce aisle, you know those little sticky stickers little on produce, the PLU labels? There's a way to know whether something's organic or not. If that label is 4 digits and begins with the number 4, it is not organic. If it is 5 digits and begins with the number 9, it is organic. Sometimes it even says organic on it, but not always. So 5 digits begins with the 9, it's organic produce. What once you discover this, maybe you'll become like me. I get obsessed about it when I go to grocery stores and I check to see if they've properly stocked their organic, and I move the strawberries that were, say they're, you know, have the organic sign but actually aren't organic, I move them, or, you know, so there's a way that you might get obsessed about it like me, but that's very, very practical. Something that I definitely rely on. And then the third thing to respond to that question about kind of what is it getting watered down, can we trust it? You know, the USDA organic certification it does tell you some very specific things about your food when it comes to produce. You know, it tells you that most synthetic chemicals were not used to produce that food. It was not grown with sewage sludge. It was not irradiated. It was not grown with genetically modified foods. I mean, it promises you those things. When it comes to organic meat and dairy, there are also kind of a set of promises that you get. And there are a number of groups around the country that are working very hard to keep the integrity of that USDA organic seal in place so that you and I, as consumers, when we go to the supermarket and we see that USDA organic seal, that it really means something. But it is important to remember that this is not a certification that's kind of written in cement that will never change. There's constant attempts by many players in the food industry to try to get their ingredient added to that okay list or to make changes in it. And if this is something you're particularly passionate about, there are groups to connect with that you can add your voice when that organic integrity gets threatened.
Thank you. And you know, this time of year is the time of year when farmers markets are opening up all around the Bay Area. And I know from my personal experience and just watching the phenomenon over the past couple of years that I think just about every city over about 30,000 people has a farmers market. And so I wonder, and me, I'm always a little suspicious that, you know, they didn't stop at Costco on the way in, maybe it's just me, but there are so many of these places opening now, and where are all these people coming from? But what are some key things that we should be asking or looking for when we're at a farmer's market?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is you're absolutely right that there are so many farmer's markets now. I'm always struck by remembering that as recently as the mid-1970s, there were only a few hundred farmers markets really sort of tracked and out there. The USDA just released their last census of farmers market, and I think the total was 6,123. 6,123. And if you know anything about a farmer's market, you know these don't just kind of pop up naturally. These are communities that had to work very hard to make them happen and keep them thriving. And they're all different. And so, you know, I think that that when you go to a farmer's market in your community, or if you want to start a farmer's market, there are lots of resources to start them. You know, it's really finding out who the farmers are and what are their production practices, and knowing that I've met a lot of farmers who sell to farmer's markets who aren't certified USDA organic. And they tell me they're not because their only market is the farmer's market, and they or direct to consumer programs like community supported agriculture programs where they have shareholders in the farm that are farm members. And essentially, they know their customers. And so for some of these farmers, they feel like they don't need this third-party certification because they have an open-door policy with their customers. They have people come visit the farm. You know, they're very open about it. So that's one thing also to know at farmers markets. You're not always going to be buying from organic certified producers, but hopefully they're going to be using good practices. The final thing I would say is good farmers markets all come down to good farmers market managers. And again, there's differences. Some farmers markets are producer only, meaning you have to be a producer to sell. Other ones, they do have, I wouldn't necessarily think they went to Costco, but you have people who are buying from farmers and then selling them. So there's different ones out there. There's 6,100 and more of them, 123, yeah.
Okay, and so it sounds like really we just need to be intelligent consumers and ask a few questions before we go.
And ahead. I would say if your produce looks a little blemished, it's probably good to eat. It's amazing what percentage of agricultural pesticides in this country are used just to make our fruit look pretty. And so that's been, as I've gotten educated about these issues, I look for like the ugliest, ugliest for the radio listeners, I'm putting this in quotes, ugliest apple. You know, those are the ones that I know didn't get that cosmetic agricultural pesticide.
Yeah, I'm sure your daughter just loves it when you come home and says, this was the ugliest. I'm only kidding. Let me ask a question that I think is very interesting that one of the members of the audience wants to point out, which is that basically only about a fifth of the people at this talk are men. And so we're not trying to draw any big conclusions here, but we just ask from based on your experience, does this issue break down in gender lines or not?
Well, so is this questioner wanting me to say women are smarter, women are mothers, I mean, men are fathers, but, you know, we have that. No, I'm just teasing. So, I mean, if you actually look at the data, the USDA, one of the fastest growing sectors of farmers in this country are actually women farmers.
Huh.
Yeah. So, and in my own work, I've certainly seen a huge percentage of the people in kind of working on sustainable food issues are women. I was just at Chatham University for their kind of inaugural lecture for their new food studies master's program. They're one of the few master's programs in food studies, and in of their class of 26, I think they have two men. So, but I'm not going to put myself out there on the line and speculate more about this, but we're certainly seeing it. For sure.
Well said. Let me ask you another kind of population question, which is, especially here in the Bay Area, we have such a change and such diversity that has come into this area in the past 20 years. I think we're now, there's no majority. It's probably 49% white, 25% Latino, 25% Asian, numbers going going up all over. How is this changing diversity going to impact this movement? I mean, both in terms of understanding, reaching out to people of different cultures, as well as just the kind of foods that have become available.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you raised that point, because the second fastest growing sector of farmers in this country are new immigrants. There's, there are a number of people who are coming to the U.S. as immigrants who are farmers in their home country and bringing with them incredible skills, incredible knowledge, incredible expertise in unique crops. And there's the federal New Farmer Development Program has been helping some of those new farmers. There's some nonprofit national groups that are working on kind of new immigrant farmer networks. But I think what I've certainly seen is that going back to kind of one of the themes of the talk is kind of what is people's perception about these issues. One of the other things I've noticed is there's this perception that when you talk about sustainable food movement or people that are working on these issues, I think people think of Michael Pollan or Alice Waters, and I love Alice and Michael's work, but I think people have this idea that it's just kind of these maybe people who live in Berkeley, and they're all white and they're middle-aged, they're working on these issues. And again, no discredit to the incredible leadership that the two of them have shown, and of course many other people who fit that demographic. But I would argue, based on my experience of spending 10 years going around this country, talking to groups on the ground who are working to try to build a more sustainable and just food system, that it is so diverse, that there are so many people working on this issue, that there are especially so many young people that are really activated. And we don't always see them as spokespeople in the mainstream media. We don't always hear their voices in the media. But these are the people that are really on the ground making change happen. And so one of the myths I think you hear from kind of the food industry is the only people who really care about this, they're just rich white people who live in certain zip codes. And, you know, I'm basically here to say, no, this is happening everywhere, all across the country, and some of the most brilliant, passionate, and effective voices have been, these really real in places all around the country, not just the Berkeleys and the Brooklyns.
Well, so let's talk then just a little bit more about what we can do on the local level, because we're currently sitting on a hillside in Saratoga that when Senator Phelan built this house 100 years ago, he would look out the windows that we're looking at, and he would see a green valley. He would see farms, he would see orchards, and for years it was known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Well, the Green Valley is now Silicon Valley, and many of those orchards are gone, and instead we have buildings and lots of jobs. So what can we do on the local level to try to preserve some of the land, maybe participate more in land use decisions? Are there places we should be looking and trying to be active?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great question, and I think what's been so exciting for me as I've been learning what's happening around the country is, as I mentioned the last question, just how much is happening. And mm-hmm. I certainly don't have my finger on the pulse of what's happening here. But I know I'll bet anybody in this room that there are incredible groups working in this region, and it's a matter of connecting with them and finding them. And there's some groups that work statewide. There's a group, actually a network of groups that's working on, in California on food and climate called CalCan, I think it's called. Great. Roots of Change is also a statewide group that would also be a way to connect with what's happening locally. Yeah. And I would guarantee you that there is much, much happening here.
Yeah, and I bet they'd be at some of the farmers markets and things.
That's
like
right,
that
absolutely.
In terms of networking for mm-hmm. that. Great. You mentioned your daughter earlier.
I did.
And thank you for doing that. And, of course, one question, because I think as parents we've all faced this, which is what's really good to feed your child when it's younger? And the baby food, remember the jars that were 80%
right.
sugar or whatever?
That's right.
So
right.
did you find any kind of family-friendly, nutritious mm-hmm. foods, or did you have to make everything?
Yeah. Well, talk about spin machine. I mean, the whole baby food this whole sort of baby food industry and when I had my daughter, so she's almost two, when I had her, I mean, I had a lot of like, well, yeah, this seems so complicated. There's all these books you can buy on how to make your kid baby food and what you should feed them. And then I started reading some of them and I started thinking about it. And I bought even this little like special baby food hand mill thing. It of course, broke the first time I used it. And then I started reading some more. And Dr. Alan Green, who's based in this region, he wrote a book called Feeding Baby Green. I wrote the foreword to it. And his work has been really influential to me. The more I started reading all this stuff, I was like, wait a second. Babies can pretty much just eat what we eat. So therefore, I can feed my daughter what I eat. So therefore, I don't need to make special food for my daughter. Depending on how many teeth she has in her mouth, I either need to blend it to a puree or blend it to a chunky soup or give it to her solid. And it doesn't, I mean, of course there are, you know, a few things like not honey until they're one. And there are some kids that have propensities to allergies. You want to be careful with certain allergenic foods. But basically, the vast majority of the human population can eat a diversity of foods, and that actually there is this window of opportunity when they are young, before they can start walking, where we are hardwired to accept a diversity of foods, and that we are hardwired once we start walking to be a bit more, let's call it discerning. Some might call it difficult. Some might call it the terrible twos, but that start earlier than two. But you know, we're hardwired to be discerning because when we were out there in the woods and could walk around and out there in the wild, we wouldn't want our young children to pick any berry off the tree and eat it, right? So we're hardwired to, at a certain point, put up resistance to foods. But that passes. And prior to that point, we're certainly open to diversity of foods. And so I think what I have just experienced is that when you kind of shed a lot of that anxiety of, is my kid going to eat the right foods and what are the right foods and when can I introduce that and that, that actually mealtime doesn't have to be this, you know, thing you feel like you need a PhD for, that it can be very, very simple. And as one of my, and I'm not a nutritionist, so maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but I took the advice of one of my friends who has a dear friend who's an Irish nurse. She's been a nurse for 40 years. And she said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, as long as your kid is getting 3 good meals in 2 weeks, they're eating fine. I was like, okay, I am achieving that. She's getting 3 good meals.
I wish I had known that 20 years ago.
And I think this is so important because, you know, our relationship to food, it starts, I think, in utero, you know, and I think that the habits we show our kids are habits that they're going to have their whole lives. And to be relaxed about food and to be open to trying new things and experiment, I mean, that is, you know, the best lesson you can give your kids, and something we've certainly tried to do.
Yeah, I have a 21 and a 23-year-old. I want to try to introduce that to. No, thank you. So we've talked about some of the problems, both locally through the state and the country. Can you talk a little bit about some places that are doing it right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they are cities or states and perhaps even other countries where you've seen examples where they're protecting the environment, sustainably growing food, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I have so many, it's hard to pick.
That's good.
Pick them. Yeah, no, yeah. It is really exciting how many examples there are. And let me just give one international and then one domestic. The international one, and the reason why I bring it up is because a lot of the things that we saw in this place, I'm starting to see all across our country. So, and a lot of people have been learning from this place and bringing it back here. So it's a place called Belo Horizonte. It's the fourth largest city in Brazil, or was the fourth largest when we were there. It means beautiful horizon in Portuguese. And my mother and I went there for research for our first book, Hope's Edge. And we went there because we had heard that this city government of Belo Horizonte in 1993 had seen the rates of hunger in their city and diet-related illnesses, you know, all these things that we have in our cities. And they, as a city government, said to themselves, to each other, don't we have a responsibility to every single citizen who lives in our city, not just the wealthy? And if we have that responsibility, then don't we have a responsibility to ensure that every single citizen here has access to good, healthy, affordable food? Isn't that our responsibility? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what we were elected to do? And it was the shift of consciousness. You know, throughout the talk, I was sort of talking about what are the shifts of consciousness we need. And this is one of those shifts of consciousness that for this city government, it unleashed incredible policy-making creativity. It didn't mean that the next day they opened 1,000 new soup kitchens and just gave away free food. It meant that they started to look at how could they use their dollars more effectively as a city government. So taking the money they were spending on corporate processed unhealthy food in the schools and buying organic, sustainably raised food from regional farmers. Taking city-owned land that was idle and letting local farmers use that land in exchange for asking them to charge a somewhat subsidized price and not charge as much for those products. Doing things like looking at where there wasn't that kind of market competitiveness that I mentioned earlier. So just like a lot of our cities in Belo Horizonte, some of the poorest neighborhoods actually had the highest prices for foods. Why? Because there was no market competition. And so these low-income consumers were getting price gouged. So the city government said, well, what if we partner with the local university and the local radio stations and we come up with the 40 most common foods that are eaten in the city and the lowest prices and where you can get those lowest prices, and we post them everywhere so everybody knows. And what it did is it brought those prices in those low-income communities in line with where they should be. And innovation upon innovation, and I could go on and on and on, but I'll stop with those few and simply say this, that by the time we got there, they had already seen a dramatic decrease in the infant mortality rate, which is, of course, one of the signs of kind of health and hunger. And, had already seen these incredible changes happen, and all from this real shift of consciousness about what's their role and what's the role of policymaking.
And does that place that place in Brazil stand out like an island to you, or
when we were there, we met with Adriana Aranha, who's one of the leaders of the program when we were there, and we've stayed in touch with her over the years. So this was in early, this was in 2000 that we were there. We stayed in touch with her a few years ago. I brought her to a North American conference on food security in Canada, and she presented on her work in Brazil and in Belo Horizonte. And in that presentation, she told us that she had just come from a national conference in Brazil, because she had been, under President Lula, brought into the national government and tasked, along with many colleagues, with bringing the kinds of lessons that they learned in Belo Horizonte to the entire country of Brazil. And she had just been at this conference where I think there were 1,200 people from municipalities throughout the country. So the kinds of things that they were doing in Belo Horizonte have now spread across the entire country. I mean, not to say that, you know, hunger has ended in Brazil, everybody, news alert, but simply to say that there are strides being made and there's a real difference being seen.
Terrific. Thank you. And we have, unfortunately, just time for one last question. And we couldn't let you escape from Silicon Valley without talking to you about apps. and specifically about food apps that, or cooking apps that you know might be out there. And and personally, I think there is some innovation to be done out there that could help all of us consumers in terms of reading labels, et cetera.
Yeah.
But what do you think about an app?
Well, and as a complete expert on this, of someone who has a BlackBerry with no apps on it, I will proceed to speak as if I am an expert. No, I'm just kidding. No, I think that you're absolutely right.
You have friends who have apps.
I have friends who have apps. I have friends who have told me about their food apps. Uh-huh. I have friends, for instance, I just saw recently one of my favorite cookbooks is Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. He has How to Cook Everything and then How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, and he's fabulous. I love his recipes for their simplicity and ease of use. Apparently, he's got a great app for that cookbook. But I think that this point about sort of how do we use technology like apps to help us consumers not be so confused in the marketplace, and I'm sure there are out there apps that are helping you understand what certain labels mean. If there aren't, they should be out there. I mean, I'd love to see, you know, the Silicon Valley community. This is one of those places where you mentioned earlier, you know, where can innovation play itself out in the marketplace. You know, having apps that help us navigate the marketplace for food would be so fabulous.
Yeah, thank you, because I think much of what you talked about today is people just being able to recognize, do it in a time-efficient way, et cetera, and some apps would probably help out. Well, thank you, and I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program, brought to you by the Montalvo Arts Center and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Anna LaPay, founding principal of Small Planet Institute and author of Diet for a Hot Planet. And I want to thank you all again for joining us. Good night.
Thank you.